You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good morning, all. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the fourth Carnegie Junior Fellows Conference. We began this conference in 2006 in the hope of connecting young professionals with some of the very best minds in foreign policy and with each other. And in particular, with the hope that we would pull together people whose backgrounds are in very different sectors, and that you would then have the chance to see how that really contributes to problem solving, to bring together viewpoints from economics, from security, from intelligence, from business, and from the NGO sector and civil society, and to see how much that helps find answers to some tough problems. So it's a real pleasure to have you here. And I think that this year's Junior Fellows class has pulled together a wonderful program for you, which I hope you will take real advantage of. The theme for today is to examine the role of emerging powers in three critical areas in climate, as you've heard, in climate change, nonproliferation, and the international economic system. And to do this at a moment of extraordinarily rapid transition in U.S. foreign policy, probably the most rapid change I think I've just about ever watched in a period of several decades in working in this field. The administration is putting out, even with very few people in place, and with a global economic crisis to deal with, an astonishing amount of fundamental policy change, and both on critical issues from Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Iran and Russia and arms control to the broader questions of how the U.S. relates to the rest of the world. And that, in turn, is leading other countries to recalibrate their own approaches to a lot of critical issues. This moment coincides, as you know, I think, with the greatest period of economic upheaval in 65 years, at least, we hope. It will just turn out to be the worst downturn since World War II. And we have governments and financial institutions trying to arrest the damage and reignite growth on a national basis. We still have a real risk that countries are going to try to shelter themselves from the political pressures that come as a result through protectionism. And at the same time, it's clear that while countries try to deal with their problems on a national basis, we are also going to have to reinvent the international financial architecture to reflect the astonishing degree of which a country's economic well-being has come to depend on others and indeed on the world as a whole. Another way of saying the degree to which the world economy has become globalized. We entered this crisis with national economic management and a global economy, and the real question is, what are we going to exit it with? And I think we don't know the answer to that yet. I want to just pause for a minute because what I just said about globalization reminds me of something, a word of just to plant in your heads for the future. It is I've seen over and over, and this is clearly a case of it, where we all get used to talking about a new phenomenon, in this case, globalization, and very quickly stop looking behind it to what is actually happening on the ground. So we've all been saying, well, the global economy's gotten globalized, the world economy, and very few people, including the people whose business it was to really notice, ever stop to say, okay, what actually does that mean? And when you look back at the big papers and ideas and books and thoughts that change the way people think over time, and a very high percentage of those are times when somebody stopped and just looked at what was conventional wisdom and sort of turned the rock over and looked underneath it to actually ask whether this word or idea that we've become also used to thinking about, what it actually meant in reality, and did it mean what we thought it meant. So this is obviously hard to do, to look behind conventional wisdom, but it is a very a fruitful thing to do, and one that leads to a lot of important insight, and would have meant a great deal had somebody done it in the recent past. While we're struggling with this economic crisis, we also have the non-proliferation regime creaky at best. And I think in danger of real collapse. Basically, what has happened is very simple. The NPT, we have learned over the last several decades, two decades, has a mortal Achilles heel in it, in allowing countries free access to technologies that produce direct access to fissile material. And what we learned first in Iraq in the 80s, and then in North Korea and Iran, is that it is impossible to safeguard in any meaningful way a nuclear establishment that has those technologies, enrichment or reprocessing, because it is such an easy step from accumulating fissile material to making a nuclear weapon. Unfortunately, we learned this just at the moment when the non-nuclear weapon states began to be more and more and more distressed with the feeling that the nuclear weapon states had failed to uphold their end of the nuclear bargain, which was to move to disarmament. This is the so-called Article 4 and Article 6 commitments of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So where we are now, and where we have been for the last 10 years or so, or maybe not quite that long, is on the one hand a realization that to fix this problem, we've got to tighten the restrictions in the nuclear regime, ask countries to take on more burdens and more responsibilities on the one hand, at the same moment that the non-nuclear weapon states, which heavily overlap, not totally, with the emerging nations that you are focusing on today, at the same moment that those countries have reached a level of near sort of terminal frustration or anger with the nuclear weapon states and won't even discuss such steps of taking until they see some real motion on moving towards disarmament. So you have a situation where I think even the very first step, or let me say this, where the nuclear weapons states are going to have to take some fairly significant steps, and in particular the United States, which has been the laggard, I'd say, going to have to take some fairly significant steps that won't have a direct payoff. In other words, steps that, in a sense, that the non-nuclear states feel they've already paid for. And the first of those, in my view, is the ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And that only begins sort of to get us up to zero, to the ground level. And then we're going to have to take some further steps before we can really begin, I think, to begin to rebuild a stronger non-proliferation regime. I have gone beyond my role here as an introducer, but this is a field I've worked in for 25 years, and I'm sorry I went a little far. And you can ignore it and talk to the real experts about it. And as if both of these problems were not enough, we also have arrived at a moment when there is a need for urgent action on climate change. And here, too, the cooperation between developed and developing countries is going to be crucial to getting the much-needed agreement, if not in Copenhagen this year, which I very much doubt, then soon thereafter. There are three contextual points that I would urge you to think about as you get into the real policies of cap and trade versus tax versus adaptation money, et cetera, et cetera. And these three are very basic. First, this is a uniquely difficult problem because the lifetime of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is so long that it means that at any given point in time, there is a huge amount of accumulated change that is already committed to in the pipeline, so to speak, but not yet felt. And that is a problem for which policymakers of all kinds are fundamentally ill-suited. It is the hardest problem for a policymaker to deal with when they know there's been some change, but it hasn't been felt and can't be you know, proven to be there, even although it certainly can be scientifically. The second one is that although this is a global problem, indeed the quintessential global problem, affecting every country, there are actually only a handful of significant causers of the problem, political actors. I use rather than countries because the EU is one of them. Fewer than 10 account for 80% of the problem. And yet, we are somewhat committed to dealing with this in a terribly cumbersome world forum of 190 countries. And so one of the big issues, of course, is does that make sense? Is that the right way to move forward with this, where countries, dozens of countries that really are irrelevant to the creation of the problem can stop action? And the third contextual point, of course, is the past versus the future, that the countries that have created this problem, the developed countries, responsible for 75% of what's up there in terms of greenhouse gas accumulation, are not the countries that are the future causes of emissions growth, which is all coming from the developing countries. So you have almost a perfect non-overlap between those that got us here and those that are taking us forward. And that, too, lies behind years and years and years of inaction on this problem. We work on all three of these issues a lot at Carnegie. And one of the reasons that we do is that we have a fundamental conviction that underlies much of our work, maybe all of it. And it is that the U.S. ability to lead has been deeply impaired by a disinclination that has been growing ever since the end of the Cold War to listen. And the reason for that is that if you want to be a leader, you got to have followers. And if you want to have followers, you've got to be able to address their interests. And to address their interests, you've got to know what they are. You've got to understand how others see the problems, how they frame the issues, how they feel their needs. Tom and I were just in talking about Iran, and I don't want to steal his thunder. I won't. But that is a critical element of making policies that work for a global problem, and it's one that the U.S. Has lost ground on, and lost ground on long before the Bush administration. This is a longer trend than that. The second point that's needed for problems like the three you are going to grapple with today, of course, is the need for foresight and for trying to craft a strategic approach for getting out of the weeds and looking at strategies and not tactics, so that we can begin to address issues like that while they're still at a manageable stage. And several of these are probably already beyond that. This tends not to be, as it is so often claimed, a matter of intelligence, of knowing what's happening. Generally, we know. It's much more a matter of being able to muster political will, and still is, I think, for all of these issues. People looking back 25 years from now, I guarantee you, 20, 25 years from now, on climate change, for example, are going to ask, what was the world doing between 1990 and 2010? When it was obvious what was happening with climate change, and it did nothing. What were they thinking? I promise you, you guys will be around to know this, so you can check whether I'm right. So this was a matter of political will, not of in intelligence, in my view. So this brings me to wish you a very successful day and the nice privilege of introducing your keynote speaker, Dr. Thomas Finger, who is currently the Payne Distinguished Lecturer with the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. He has had a long and distinguished career in government, serving as Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, INR, at the State Department, and several positions in INR below that, and most recently as the first Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Analysis, and concurrently with that, as chairman of the National Intelligence Council, the body in the U.S. government that pulls together the best analytic understanding in the many, many intelligence agencies that we have and produces national intelligence estimates, among other things. But it is the core of the analytic work of our intelligence community. Under his direction, the NIC released the most recent Global Trends book, Global Trends 2025, A Transformed World, which took a fresh look at key global trends that might influence us or the world over the next 15 years. I participated in an earlier version of that, and I can tell you it's one of the few exercises that really gives you a kind of a synoptic overview of the important global trends. So he has, through all of his work, at INR and at the NIC and as a Deputy Director of National Intelligence, I think a rare, if not unique, vantage point to see all the intersecting issues and cross-cutting ones that affect us. Given the agenda for today's meeting, I can't think of anyone that would have been a more appropriate or a better keynoter for it. I think you are enormously lucky to have him with you, and I want to express our gratitude to him for joining us for this event. So please join me in welcoming Tom Finger.
Thank you, Jessica, for the introduction. Let me first associate myself with Jessica's introductory remarks on several points. It makes it I don't have to work them into my own presentation. I thought as she was working her way toward the introduction that she was going to say something like she kicked over the rock of globalization and found your speaker this morning. Congratulations to Carnegie. I mean, this is a terrific program. Congratulations to you for being in it. As I sat up here looking out, I was reflecting on the great many times over the last 25 years that I have been in this room and rooms like it for programs. And you should anticipate doing the same. You should think about this as the beginning of an involvement with important American and foreign policy issues. We don't have enough good people in the game, and thank you for volunteering for it. Let me begin by asking you to use your imagination. If I use PowerPoint, I could give you some cartoons. But what I'd like to do is each of you develop your own little image. We'll come back to this later. If you close your eyes for a minute. The first is a hill or a mountaintop with Uncle Sam standing on it and a bunch of other countries sort of climbing up. And sort of the weight of them climbing up has got an earthquake of sorts going. Now shift over to the second one, which is the same hilltop. Uncle Sam's on it, and he's reaching down to help others get to the top. And the third is an Uncle Sam that is pushing back to remain king of the hill. File those away in the back of your mind, but do keep them in the back of your mind as you hear. You can open your eyes, those of you who thought this was a chance to go to sleep. As you think about the issues and whether or not they are issues that are best dealt with through cooperation, what the instincts are to view them as zero sum, if somebody else wins, the United States loses. And remember that first image. The mountain is shaking. Tectonic plates moving. We're in a different time. Let me set the stage with some very almost telegraphically oversimplified parameters that I think are important to bear in mind. I suspect they're not particularly new or controversial, so I won't elaborate on them. The first is that the unipolar moment is over. The decade or so of unquestioned American hegemony has come and gone. There are people who don't yet recognize that. There are people who recognize it and want to turn back the hands of time. But it's over. So, too, is the bipolar world that we came very accustomed to during the Cold War. We don't need to go back to the bipolar world. It's unlikely that we'll return to one very soon, and it's undesirable. Thinking back to the halcyon days where we were moments away from nuclear annihilation doesn't give me warm and fuzzy feelings. There was a certain predictability and stability and familiarity to it, but we don't need a world divided into us and them. For that to happen, we will have to be even more stupid than I think we're capable of being. The third point, though, around structure is that we are into a period of time that is not quite multilateral. It's not unipolar. It's not bipolar. It's somewhere between chaos and functional multilarity. Historically, these are the most unstable times. Empires and stable balance of power kind of hold things in check, the clear rules. We're into one of those periods of history where we've more or less run off the map, have to make it up as we go along. The making it up as we go along, the re-engineering the world to take into account the successes, tremendous successes over the last six decades, the rise of the new big powers, the rise of the rest, I'll come back to these. But part of this reason it is tough is the erosion of U.S. preeminence. The U.S. remains and will remain for some time the preeminent power in the world. We're not in decline. But the gap between the U.S. and the rest is narrowing. I believe this is a good thing, but it is a change that requires adjustment in attitude, adjustment in policy, adjustment in behavior, adjustment in expectation, not just in this strange town, but around the world. And we're in a, okay, it's not the good old days, but where are we? And what role should the U.S. play? And to underscore a point that Jessica made, a U.S. that is perceived to have stopped listening, a U.S. that is perceived to have shifted from a pursuit of self-interest that was defined as being in the interest of a much larger community, then we called it the free world, into one that looks more like just any other big power looking out for itself. I think that's partly right, partly wrong, but it's certainly unfortunate. Underscore, the U.S. is not in decline. We still have an exceptionally important role to play and a capability to do that. And the rise of the rest, to use Fareed Zakaria's term, the rise of the BRICS, to use the Goldman Sachs, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, was made possible by U.S. policy, by institutions and an international order that were built with U.S. leadership, that were maintained with U.S. economic, military, political leadership over a period of decades. is sort of, rather than being dismayed at the world that is a-making, there should be a certain amount of justifiable pride that this has happened. Was there a blueprint? Did anybody know exactly how this? No. But the institutions that were put in place, actions taken as a part of Cold War security, an open architecture arrangement in the Cold War, that anybody wanted to join our side, participate in policies that brought about stability and prosperity, was welcome to join with no notion of a minimum winning coalition. That as long as you weren't going to be on the side of the Soviet Union, that was fine. Now, there were some downsides to that, except an awful lot of sleazebag governments and unacceptable behavior to be on our end of the tug-of-war rope. But it was an open-arms approach. The rise of the new big powers, and the ones that always get focused on are China, India, the resurgence of Russia, and Brazil. Too often these discussions forget that this is a long evolutionary process with multiple waves. The rebuilding of Europe after World War II, the integration of Europe, NATO, the move towards the EU, the expansion of NATO and the EU, the revival of Japan, the rise of the little tigers in the 80s and 90s in East Asia. We're seeing now sort of the next stage that happens to involve some very big countries in terms of population, the two biggest in the world. In terms of area, two of the biggest in the world. In terms of resource endowment, continental size, very much different for the international system to digest than a rise of a Republic of Korea, for example. And there are others waiting in the wings. That the 2025 study said the next tranche of likely candidates includes Indonesia, another very large country, Turkey, and Iran. That we can talk about the reasons they're in that tranche. My bottom line, which is not universally shared, is that the rise of the rest is good, or at least is more good than bad, that it doesn't automatically, necessarily disadvantage the United States, but it does certainly make it more complicated to get at a list of problems. It complicates the process and the problems of system maintenance. Jessica mentioned the international financial institutions. The 2025 study looked out and it said all of these post-World War II institutions, alliance structures, the United Nations, the financial, the arms control regimes, are all looking kind of long in the tooth, not so well suited for the world of tomorrow. The world of yesterday is gone, and a need to make adjustments. And to underscore, and I'll repeat it later, one of the dilemmas of the challenges here, the last time we did this, the international system, it was basically the United States deciding what to do, telling the Brits that's what we wanted to do, them saying okay, and it was done. Now we've got, for starters, the rise of the other big powers. We don't have the world divided into two camps. And we've got 140 more countries. And should participation in critical decision making extrapolate from the climate change, involve just those with the biggest stake, who are the biggest violators, or since everybody lives in this world, and it's going to be the poor people on the Cook Islands that are submerged first, should they be in the dialogue? And our views of participation, of democracy, of equality have changed over the last 60 years in ways that sort of tip toward universal participation, which is a formula for paralysis, on an agenda that is inherently urgent. Let me run through briefly something old, something new kinds of ideas about the rise of the four big powers. The rise of Japan, the restructuring or the revival of Europe was a good thing because it strengthened the free world. Nobody worried very much. Indeed, there was a lot of applause when the European economy was back on its feet. Trade between the U.S. and Europe shut up. We repeated that in East Asia, thought to be a good thing because there was an us versus them character. Remember, the Cold War's over. Bipolar world is gone. There's not the automatic predisposition to regard growth of our friends, strengthening of our partners as a good thing. Another difference, besides the end of the bipolar world, is that the four big powers include two that were adversaries of the United States, Russia and China, and two that have sort of made their niche through the last several years by being in favor of non-alignment, non-intervention, rigid respect for sovereignty. A strange conversation with Brazilian diplomats some years ago about how they were now entitled to a seat on the Security Council so that they could bring Brazil's perspective into the front rank of international consideration. But I said, I don't get it, because your unique contribution is non-involvement. Why in the world would you want to be on a body that exists to meddle in the affairs of others? And that the disconnect there was on both sides. On this, but they don't automatically fall into a pre-existing category of either clearly good or clearly bad here. The other is size matters. Sort of digesting the Czech Republic is not a momentous task for the international system. Digesting an India and a China, you can't envision an international system doing that and not being transformed. But transformed how? By whom? For what purpose? With voices to which of the players? The size of the population. Whether one talks about requirements for energy in order to have industrialization, to create jobs, to have improved quality of life, sort of a couple more barrels of oil per person per year, and we have just exceeded the capacity of the global oil system. The amount of pollutants strewn into the atmosphere, not just the carbon and the greenhouse gases, all of the industrial pollutants being dumped into water that is causing deterioration of agricultural land and health and so forth. These are big problems that need to be tackled together. And do we slow our rate of growth in order to grow cleanly and responsibly, or do we continue rapidly developing in order to achieve higher levels of industrial competitiveness, economic competitiveness, military security, prosperity for our people? Who should pay the price? The guys who are already rich, or the ones who are trying to become less poor on this? Complicated because governments everywhere, democracies and authoritarian states, are increasingly accountable to their populations. It's part of the globalization, part of transparency, part of rising expectations, part of youth bulge, part of universal cell phones and all of the like, that even the harshest dictator can no longer disregard public attitude Because you might get a local version of Al-Qaeda. You might get a revolution. Even if you merely get brain drain, your best and brightest pull out of the country. So they got to pay attention in this. There is the possibility, and by saying it that way, I'm not attempting to minimize the likelihood of it, but there's a possibility of a competitive model to the Washington consensus. The democracy plus markets model that worked pretty well in the rise of the free world proved its superiority to the communist planned alternative. But now we've got in China, in Russia, and to considerably lesser degree in India and Brazil, a different model. The China and Russia, the slogan is authoritarian capitalism, prosperity without democracy. I believe that's a gross oversimplification. Having worked on China since 65, it is a lot more liberal and democratic in many respects than it was, and I think it's moving in that direction. We can talk about it. But this model needs to be thought of not just as a who supplants whom, who proved that the model for the 21st century struggle is not necessarily Western-style capitalism with democracy. It's think of all of those countries that are not yet democratic. Think about most of the Middle East. That the appeal of a growth model that allows maintenance of high degree of authoritarianism probably has some appeal if you're a king, rather than a leap into direct democracy or liberal democracy. So to the extent that there's some self-interest and appeal, there will be opportunities for exaggerated perceptions of influence and alignments that will color interactions that may in fact be purely commercial or may be quite instrumental in tackling problems like the three that you're going to focus on today. Before leaving the rising powers, we got this note, all of them are much more vulnerable than the fearmongers of the American era is over, the G2 with China, the Russia resurgent, they're all vulnerable. And the current financial crisis has underscored that for them as well as for outside observers. But think of the demographics. India and China, 1.3 billion and 1 billion people. Satisfying aspirations of that many people. Then look at the demographics, the age structure of this. And you begin to get an idea of why Chinese officials worry about growth slipping less than 8% of the year. I don't know what the figure is, but they got to grow at some very significant rate in order to create jobs for the 12 to 15 million urban youth who will enter the workforce every year. 15 million jobs a year. We'd love to have 15 million jobs in a decade. And we're better at creating than anybody is. Russia's got a different problem. It's the only one of the few countries on the world, certainly the only developed country with a declining life expectancy. All that land and not so many people. And they're going to be beneficiaries of global warming. So you think that the notion that the czar had about yellow peril and Chinese moving across the border, why would they move across to build an igloo? They might move across when it's now warm enough to cultivate. To articulate this is to exaggerate it. But exaggeration sort of is the lifeblood of politics. And as you think about tackling these problems, you have to think not only about what's causing it, what's possible, but what's the political arena in which this is going to have to be debated, and what are the nonsensical ideas that are going to have to be beaten back, and which ones are nonsensical, and which ones are simply worst case. Let me go for a couple of minutes on some of the new challenges and possibilities. Again, operating at a high level of generality here. The old order is fraying, but it is responsible for the success that we've got today. And there's a reluctance to move away from it. It hasn't failed. And until something has really dramatically failed, the normal tendency is to hang on to it, particularly in the absence of a better idea or a better way to get to a better idea. That one can see quite clearly that a whole range of institutions are becoming less capable and less relevant. We did the 2025 study. We used the global financial system as our illustration. We were just bringing this to closure in late fall when we realized that the future was now. These things had failed more rapidly than we had anticipated. I don't know what the implications are for other pieces of the international system, but this may have a greater urgency to it. Thank you, than had anticipated previously. The erosion of U.S. preeminence, the legacy of the triumphalism that Jessica referred to, the end of the Cold War, the breastfeeding, the we don't need you anymore kind of attitude, has put us in a hole that we're going to have to get out of before we can provide the kind of leadership that's going to be necessary to bring the world together, to meet the challenges and realize the possibilities. We can do it. I mean, I think the world wants us to succeed in this. Again, there's a window here where the hope that the new administration will be successful, the hope that the United States will return to a model of the past and will be able to do this, we need to take advantage of it. Finding partners in the rising power may be tricky because they benefit very much from the current system. They're defenders of the status quo. It works for them. Any restructuring imaginable is going to require more shifting of burden and burden sharing to them. And it's very convenient to point at the Americans and say, you did it wrong, you screwed up, you shouldn't have done that. It's a whole lot harder when you said, we have to do this. But we have to do it together to tackle any of the three problems that are on your agenda for the day and a whole range beyond that. And we're going to have to figure out what's the right size, how many countries, how to deal with the chicken and egg problem. Do you have to fix the international system, structure at that level, in order to be able to tackle all of the individual and interconnected problems? Or is the urgency such and the eat the elephant one bite at a time approach to tackle each of these problems with the relevant set or most relevant set of actors, thinking of it as a building block towards a ultimately reconstituted international system? There's not an obvious best way to do this. So the obvious may have to yield to the practical. And my own strong bias is that is the problem focused, bring in the players that need to be there, a nod towards universality, but getting in the room the folks who could have the biggest impact on the problem and working ahead. Let me close with reminding you of those three images. That first one, that's happening. That's not an option. That's not something that policymakers can decide they want to accept or not accept. We have historic shifts in relationships among nations, visibility of populations into the nature and the problems we confront. We can deal with these by reaching down and trying to do it together. There's no way, in my view, we can deal with them if the priority is given to retaining and expanding U.S. predominance in the system. You can't have it both ways. Let me stop there.
Thank you, Tom. We have time now for questions from you. Be tough, be succinct, and wait for the mic. Who would like to start? Yes. It'd be great if you just introduce yourself as well.
Hi. Sean Randall, World Policy Institute.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious as to whether you think the United States welcomes or tolerates the rise of the rest. And dependent on that answer, if the United States welcomes the rise of the rest, why do we spend more money on our military than the next 10 nations combined?
They're excellent questions. On this one, I don't think there is yet a single United States view. At the level of the United States government or the American people. I think this is sort of something that is malleable. The outcome is not inevitable here, that we will come down clearly on the side of this is a good thing or this is threatening to us. That if one looks at editorial opinion and so forth, it's pretty sharply divided on this. Do we need an enemy worthy of our $600 billion military budget? I think this is an excellent question. And it gets to sort of hedging strategies that the clear preference would be to work with the other big powers so that we don't become adversaries. But you get three of them that are nuclear powers. They've got big militaries, and there is a natural inclination to hedge. And hedging in this transparent world looks like we've already decided partnership won't work, and becoming adversaries is inevitable. So it's a very, very tricky issue. The size of the U.S. defense budget is linked to more than you got to have an adversary worthy of it. It has to do with extended commitments around the globe, some of which are probably valuable, extended deterrence that helps with proliferation concerns. But extension into defending resource pockets that are not any longer the oil in the Middle East. We don't get much oil from the Middle East. We pay a high political price for being out there. It costs a lot of money. My answer is there's not a clear answer, but the amount of jobs, congressional interests around the defense budget, the commitments that go beyond bilateral ones with big powers means this is going to be tough, and it's got to be tackled, otherwise there's no money to do other things.
Let me take a couple together, if that's okay.
Fine.
With you. And yeah, in the back. I'll take three, and then we'll go through.
Hi, Andrew Stevenson with Resources for the Future. Given that among the American people, climate change is usually, in opinion polls, actually ranked fairly low as compared to a lot of other issues on the U.S. agenda, but here we've ranked it as one of the top three foreign policy priorities of the U.S., and certainly I work on climate change, so I might agree with that, but I think this limits what the U.S. can do internationally on climate change. So just wondering if you have any thoughts about how to better engage the U.S. domestic population on climate change and what the relationship is with our international position.
Okay, right here.
More than ever, we're starting to recognize that failing and unstable states have a large impact not only on our own well-being, but on the rest of the world. So I just wonder where these sort of states fit into the evolving global situation.
Mm-hmm. Another good question up here.
Okay. Hi, Andrew Shepherd, INR. This is kind of a follow-up to your previous answer. Your last lines kind of reminded me of some of the mission statements of some of the more ideological think tanks that have said in their feeling the exact opposite is what they would feel would be the answer, that a continuing military presence is the best way to continue the value system. And, of course, to a large extent, that philosophy seems to have been debunked by current affairs, but a lot of people still believe that to be the case, as you raise. So the fact that we have such a varied kind of back and forth on how we're going to go about approaching the changing world order, how does that impact the way the rest of the world views our partnerships with them?
Again, all good questions. I will not do justice to them in these answers. On the climate change, what you cited is certainly congruent with my own understanding here. The American public does not view climate change, global warming, as a priority concern. I think a part of this is public education, or to be rather blunt about it, public miseducation. That the recognition or the understanding of how climate change will affect regions of the United States, severe weather along the East Coast, particularly in the Southeast, dust bowl-like conditions coming in the Southwest. Very little attention to that. More importantly is the international linkage, and it gets to the failing states one, that climate change by itself probably won't bring down a failing state, but it's that one more straw in systems that are already overstressed. And as it leads to clearly water problems and agricultural production problems, and temperature goes up a little bit, disease vectors become more of a problem. And since a sick person anywhere is a plane ride away from you and me, and influenza, that next big flu problem, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And it can get here from anywhere. So then take the other kind of examples and extrapolate out. The military posture and what you lay out of sort of, there is more sentiment behind the status quo. The reason we are so rich and the world is so stable and peaceful is because of our global military presence. The reason that the Japanese, the Koreans, and so forth haven't developed nuclear weapons is because they can rely on us. That's a true but. It worked then. Is it going to work in the future? But there is also what's the relevance of military power to the three issues that you're going to discuss today? At the margins, it has to do with proliferation, but mostly this is not relevant, or it's zero sum for resources and time and attention, or it makes it hard to persuade people of the sincerity of some U.S. Initiatives on this. By the same token, there's not an obvious replacement for the global policing role that the United States has played. We are a free good. That $600 billion budget is a free good to much of the world, to more of the world than is adversely affected by it. So the interest in preserving that exceeds the immediate interest in multilateralizing the force in Afghanistan. Maybe the pirates off Somalia is a harbinger of things to come. This is going to be very, very hard because of the vested interests that are attached to this. Communities with bases, communities with factories that manufacture for the military, the training, the strength of lobbying groups and so forth, you're right to raise it. They are interconnected, and the failing states problem, where the danger in the Caribbean means migration, concern about the humanitarian consequences of this, the Darfur-like problems. We wouldn't be the United States if we weren't concerned about these.
Okay, we have time for one more round before my team here fires me. In the back, and then we'll take these two.
Sari Nurley, Department of State. Secretary Clinton had identified development as a third pillar to foreign policy when she came into office, and I want to know, your thoughts on the role of U.S. development aid and foreign aid to countries that would have previously, because as countries who were previously recipient countries are now donor countries, what will happen to our influence outside of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Okay, I saw two more, yeah. On the aisle there. There you go. And then
Smita Lawani, New America Foundation, MIT. I appreciate the two scenarios you've laid out of the U.S. Pushing back against the rest or possibly cooperating with the rest. But I want to consider a third alternative, which is, as you suggested, we're providing a lot of free public goods. And it's possible that the rest's rise could take quite a while. And possibly our option is to retrench and wait for them to, approach us. Or perhaps, we're capable of weathering the storms perhaps better than they are. And why not wait for them to come to us? And so we can dictate the terms of cooperation or new international bargains.
Okay, right here.
Brandon Yoder, National Endowment for Democracy. I apologize for going to the hot button topic of the day, but I'd be remiss not to take the opportunity. In the past few days, we've seen a lot of media coverage on the issues of authorization of torture and intelligence collection. And I'm just wondering to what degree you see that issue shaping the United States' ability to lead in this new era. As imagery from Iraq and Guantanamo has kind of proliferated around the global media networks, the United States image comes under fire. And as we enter into this new era, be it multipolar with us helping people to the top or us trying to push people down, to what degree have we done damage to our kind of moral authority?
Let me work these backwards, just so I can. We have done great damage to our moral authority. We have lost the moral high ground, not simply because of the torture, but because of a whole range of things. And it's not quite as hard to retrieve as virginity, but it's going to be tough. Having once been the shining city on the hill, something to which others could aspire, that welcome arms, America be counted on to do the right. Having once lost that we won't get it back quickly. It's going to take effort, and it probably requires attention. Having said that, I think on the torture piece of it, most of that damage is done. I actually worry more about the distraction factor, given everything that is on the agenda of our country. This threatens to become a sideshow in the circus and divert attention in the Congress and around the executive branch. Should we wait for others to come to us? It has a certain appeal, but not very lasting for me, because I think we might wait longer than we wish. We might wait. While we're waiting, the problems are going to get worse, the urgency element of us that is there. And we still do have the capacity to lead. And in the absence of peer partners in the global leadership game, I think we've got an obligation to, even in our hobbled state, operating from the position of less moral superiority than we had. We have an obligation to do this and to tackle it now. The development aid and alternative, if I understood the question correctly, I break it into a couple pieces here. One is thinking about aid as one tool in the toolbox to tackle problems, strengthening failing states, improving health care, dealing with security concerns, education of a workforce for better jobs so it can attract investment, and the like. It's not a panacea. We've got 60 years worth of evidence that it's problematic at best. Our own system of doing it is totally broken, and my opinion should be abolished and start over again. And we don't give that much relative to the needs. I remember now a decade ago being in Kenya, and I went along with an embassy official who tried to take advantage of my visit to go in and they marched the government on something. I've even forgotten what it was. And the response was, you give us $19 million. Even in a poor country like Kenya, $19 million doesn't buy you much influence. We appreciate the money you're putting into the health system, but go away, in essence. The provision of aid by, and China is the one that is held up, China in Africa, that as wealth has migrated from west toward east, as China, as East Asia more broadly, some of the Gulf, Persian Gulf states have more wealth, that being used for development, to foster infrastructure, instead of viewing this in a kind of a knee-jerk, what are they doing in our continent, and say, Africa's not our continent, guys, saying, is this something that can be leveraged? Do we get a critical mass if we pool European, Asian, including not limited to Chinese aid, and Americans to get a critical mass in certain places to get the locomotives moving to pull the surrounding regions along? I think we ought to strive to be smarter and better because, again, the origins of the aid program was the bilateral Cold War competition. It was one more instrument to get guys to our side of the tug-of-war rope. And there's still some of that dynamic in the thinking and the rationale for aid as opposed to enlightened self-interest. If they stay healthy over there, they don't come sick over here. I probably used up more time than I should have. I thank you for the question, for the attention. Have a great time today.